Welcome to Ploughing Through Brexit, Farmers Guardian's Brexit podcast.
Hello and welcome to the latest Farmers Guardian Ploughing Through Brexit podcast with me, Will Evans.
And me, Abby Kay. Today we've got two great guests on the line to talk about the regulatory framework for plant science post-Brexit and whether leaving the EU could open the door to a new ag revolution in the UK. So first up, we have Mark Buckingham, who is the chair of the Agricultural Biotechnology Council, as well as being the corporate engagement lead for the UK and Ireland at Bayer. Hi, Mark.
Hello, Abby and Will. Hi.
And we've also got mixed farmer Paul Temple. Paul has participated in GM field scale evaluation trials, which examine the safety of GM maize, beet and oilseed rape, and is a past vice president for the NFU, chairman of the COPEC GECA Cereals, Oilseeds and Protein Group, and founder of the European Biotech Forum. Hi, Paul.
Hi there.
That's quite the CVs, chaps. I'm feeling very unaccomplished right now. Mark, before we go any further, perhaps you can start off by briefly explaining what the role of the Agricultural Biotechnology Council is.
Sure. Well, we're a sort of trade association for companies working with innovative plant breeding. So we were set up around 15 years ago focusing on GM crops. But now we're more focused on gene editing and the latest techniques, as well as still working on GM. And our members are BASF, Bayer, Corteva and Syngenta. And our goal is just to contribute to the conversation around innovation, making the case for it and for the value of plant breeding as we face challenges like climate change, growing food demand around the world, the need to be more sustainable and productive in agriculture and the role that plant breeding can play in meeting some of those challenges.
Paul, we see a lot of headlines about advanced breeding techniques like GM and gene editing, and DEFRA Secretary Michael Gove has been very positive about gene editing in particular. What do you think the likelihood is of the UK embracing those technologies after Brexit, if Brexit does ever happen? We make that joke every week, don't we?
and you can keep doing it. I think we have a positive opportunity. I mean, nothing's going to materialise in the field, but we have good research in the UK. And I think if the government sort of makes the right noises, it will encourage people to actually look at what, especially gene editing, has to offer. I think there's growing awareness that genetics are going to be the key to, you know, finding solutions to the problems we face and continuing to sort of produce food at the levels we are in a sustainable way.
And what about Labour? I mean, it's possible we could have Jeremy Corbyn in number 10 next. Would he be as open as the Conservatives to this kind of technology, do you think, Paul?
I really wouldn't be able to guess. I think we're in circumstances at the moment, actually, that we've had a unique period, which we'll look back in history and think, why didn't we see the signs earlier? We've managed through globally increasing harvests to supply the world, and the prices have remained relatively low. And that will change, and it'll probably change within a government's lifetime. And I don't think any sensible government would want to rule out any options that might actually help us produce food in the levels that we have to do in a more sustainable way.
That's a very optimistic outlook, Paul.
it is difficult to remain optimistic. I was in the European Parliament a year ago and realised it was 20 years since I took part in the field scale trials, and Europe has spent its time talking about it and doing absolutely nothing.
Well, I think we'll come on to that later. In the meantime, what kind of transformative potential do these techniques actually have in practical terms for UK farmers?
From a farmer's point, well, Mark will be better capable, but I just think there's a huge number of opportunities to solve some of the problems we currently sort of require pesticides to deal with.
Yeah, Mark, you're obviously heavily involved in this. Can you give us a specific example of a crop that's been beneficially modified through these techniques?
Well, I mean, there's a range of GM crops, which, as Paul says, have been going for well over 20 years. And there's an enormous amount of science and economic research on their benefits. So that's well established, like less pesticide use, higher yields, greater income for farmers, especially smallholder farmers in developing countries, reduce soil erosion, a huge range of benefits. In terms of gene editing, the products are mainly still in research, and there's the absolute full range of areas being looked at by scientists. So tools like nitrogen and water use efficiency, particularly in rice. Some of the greatest number of projects is in rice in gene editing, actually in China. They're one of the leaders in gene editing globally. But other techniques are around reducing food waste. So better cold storage characteristics for potatoes is a project in the USA, and also reducing acrylamide levels. So a potentially safer potato, another US project. But there's heat stress, water use efficiency, yield quality projects in a wide range of crops and all around the world. So it's a very, very broad approach that researchers are taking.
Amazing opportunities there, then.
Absolutely.
Paul, you voiced your frustration with the EU's regulatory framework. In fact, you just did it a couple of moments ago. Can you explain what it is about the EU's approach that is holding us back so much?
Well, there's two elements. One is the hypocrisy of the situation. If you're going to deny European farmers a choice of these crops, then don't subject my marketplace to other farmers that have the advantage. And Europe's, ships millions of tons of GM produce in because we're protein deficit particularly. But my other frustration is the message it sends out to those looking to research in this field of genetics and invest in it. And if Europe continues as it has done to send this negative message, this research will be carried out in other parts of the world. We won't be able to tail it to our unique circumstances, and we will be reliant on others. And we haven't anything that's going to immediately drop into a field, but the research and seeing it at first hand is so important.
I suppose that precautionary approach has been manifested by the European Court of Justice ruling recently on gene editing, where they said gene editing would have to be governed by the same regs as GM. That's effectively signalled, as you say, that the EU isn't exactly the most favourable location for research and development. So if you contrast that to countries like Canada and Australia and Argentina, for example, how much will this actually put UK farmers at a disadvantage?
It's an incredible disadvantage. I mean, Canada has GM canola and has done for years. Australia's embraced it. Argentina, interestingly, I was there recently looking at how they survived in sort of a low-income scenario, and that's what switched them to no-till. And that was possible because of GM crops, dramatically reduced the cost of production. But the big plus was the benefit to those soils. And it's the ability to see it from a whole perspective of how it relates to the environment of production that's really important. The message the European Court of Justice said was, actually, we're not really interested in science, because gene editing is totally different to genetic modification, but they dropped it in the same regulation.
Mark, I'm sure you spend a lot of time looking at this and talking to your European colleagues. Is there any chance at all of the EU's attitudes to this technology changing anytime soon?
Well, I hope so. And I agree with what Paul said, that it's important it does change. And there was a positive European Council meeting of ag ministers from around Europe a couple of weeks ago, where they recognized that decision by the European Court of Justice to put these new breeding techniques in the same category as GM was scientifically unjustified and would mean less research and less investment here in Europe. And so there's the right arguments are taking place. Does that translate into better policy? It's much too soon to tell. So we really do need to keep up the pressure, because as you said, those other countries, Australia, Argentina, Canada, USA, Brazil, that they take productive, efficient, sustainable farming more seriously as a business at a policy level. And that's something we've got to improve in Europe to have these opportunities. Because back to the point you made earlier, technology is progressive. It shouldn't be a political issue one way or another. It should be about science and choice. and effective technology helps everyone who wants to access it. If we want a traditional or artisan, you know, type of agriculture, that's a luxury. That isn't progressive. That's an expensive choice. Having options of technology helps everyone ultimately, and that's what we should be pushing for.
It's really interesting that they're having those conversations at the top level. I'm guessing that maybe they could look at introducing some policy then on gene editing specifically that would undermine that ECJ ruling. Is that your kind of thoughts on it, Mark?
Yes, I mean, that is what they're saying. They're saying they're not disagreeing with the ECJ ruling. They're saying it suggests they need to look again at the GM legislation and yeah, future-proof it, I guess, so that as science and research brings up new opportunities, new ways of doing plant breeding and potentially new tools for farmers, that the regulation should be flexible enough to allow those to come forward rather than blocking them in the way that the current GM regulations have blocked GM.
Right. So moving back to the UK, without wanting to state the obvious, we know Mrs. May hasn't been exactly the most popular PM around. In fact, just before we started recording this podcast, she stepped down. So that was big news for us. But her Chequers deal and the withdrawal agreement were probably even less popular than she was. That doesn't necessarily mean, though, that they won't form the basis of any new relationship with the EU after she's gone, depending on who takes her place. Are you concerned, Mark, that the common rule book proposed in the Chequers agreement could constrain the UK's ability to diverge from EU rules on things like this after Brexit, if it does end up coming into force?
Yes, I think you're spot on. That is a risk looking forward, that we might, if, as you say, if Brexit happens, but we remain very close to Europe, we might end up with a sort of worst of both worlds situation, where we don't have access to technology, but we don't have access to the single market either. So that is definitely a risk, and we need the UK to focus on the science, you know, make regulations based on actual risk that are proportionate to that actual risk, and that encourage innovation, and work with researchers to get innovation into farmers' hands, and then farmers can work out what the most valuable opportunities are.
Mm. The other big problem that I can foresee coming down the line, which I haven't heard people discuss very much, is about the devolved nations, who are much less open than England to the idea of GM in particular. I struggle to find an on-the-record position on gene editing from those administrations, but we know Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland have all banned GM crops. How much of a problem could this be for the UK domestic market if English farmers are given access to technology that others elsewhere are denied? Do you think it will make those farmers less competitive? And do you have a sense for whether farmers on the ground in the devolved nations actually want to grow these crops but can't? Paul, perhaps you can answer that first, and then Mark can jump in if you like.
At the moment, the devolved nations are sending a very much a negative message, which is somewhat of a surprise, especially for Scotland, that prides itself on science and actually could be a real hindrance, given there's £62 million has just gone into advanced plant and a barley hub up at the James Hutton Institute. I would hope this, again, I think this comes back to the fact that what we're talking about at the moment is we haven't got crops that are going to be immediately there. What we really want to do is encourage the open-minded approach to what gene editing can do within our country's context to take plant breeding forward and solve some of the problems we're going to face. We are going to have to look for sort of yield jumps that we haven't had in the past, and that isn't going to be possible through a conventional route. So it is genuinely a problem at the moment, but I think if we sort of have an open-minded and push this from the context of encouraging research, we can hopefully open a more constructive conversation than we've had in the past.
Mm. Yeah. Matt?
Yeah, I completely agree. That's exactly the way forward. That it's about looking at individual supply chains and offering some choice. I think I think that the GM discussion over two decades has shown it doesn't work for governments to sort of pick technologies. That really should be at a farm level for individual managers to say, well, what works for their farm business and their supply chain and their customers and their situation. and that the government and the regulation should just look at, are technologies safe, and make a scientific assessment on that basis. And then the supply chain will choose, well, who is going to use what technology. But we've also learned over those 20 years that you can have that choice. You can keep technologies separate. We've seen enormous growth, 100-fold growth in use of GM crops in the USA, at the same time as we've seen big growth in their organic market in recent decades. Yeah. Same in Australia. We see, premium wines and other foods from Australia at the same time as very rapid adoption of GM technology. Same for pests. We're having a big debate and experience with flea beetle after certain crop protection products have been withdrawn. Beetles are a good target for GM protein insect protection traits. No one's working on that, to my knowledge, for the UK. And it would take 10 plus years to get a product off the ground. But, if we want a targeted, effective solution to some of these problems, we should be deploying the science. And I hope that politicians across the UK would look at those opportunities.
Yeah. I mean, the two letters GM are very emotive. The very mention of them has often caused some extreme reactions with the public, as we know. Is that still the case now, or are attitudes to this technology starting to slowly change, Paul?
I don't, from the general public, I don't see the kind of aversion to it that there was 20 years ago.
Yeah.
I think the NGOs play it for what it's worth. It's hugely irresponsible. And to be honest, whilst I know some people might think, well, let's change the language, I have no problem with being honest and upfront about, look, this is what actually happens in agriculture. And this is important. And when you show people it at first, I took a group of student teachers to the field when we had the GM trials, and they had a mindset of what it meant. But you put them in the actual field and show them what it means, and all of a sudden, this wasn't something to frighten them. This was perfectly sensible science. So I don't think we should shy away from using clear language as to what we're doing, whether it's gene editing or genetic modification or using pesticide products. I think really being honest is important. How you get it across is really difficult when you have NGOs that can constantly put subjective, scare-ridden elements of out in the media without it being easily rebutted, because obviously in science you can't say with 100% certainty all the time.
Absolutely. Mark, we're hearing so much talk about climate change now, and governments, powerful organizations, are all setting ambitious targets around things like emissions. How much is this going to be a factor in gaining support for these technologies?
I think it helps for sure, because innovation is the way to address those challenges. How do we maintain or increase productivity while reducing the impact of that production? You can't do the same things you've been doing, because that would have the same result. You want to be more productive but put in less resource or have less impact, and that means innovation, which means science and R&D. So I think it does help the conversation. And there's many examples of less greenhouse gas emissions, less water use, better heat stress tolerance in crops, etc., from research that are directly relevant to that conversation. So, and just to comment on your sort of public perception question, ABC did some survey work last year asking 1,600 18 to 30-year-olds about their attitudes to a range of farming technologies. And about 20% of respondents said they were unsure or negative about GM in the food sector. So 80% were reasonably comfortable. And so it's still, there's a degree of controversy there, but there's also a very large majority who don't object. So I think, we should, be prepared to offer choice. That is a basis, given those challenges like climate change. There's a strong basis of support for offering choices of these technologies.
And Paul, on the farmer side, attitudes are changing too, and people are beginning to look at things like soil health much more than perhaps they have in the recent past. Will tells me that you spoke really well on this subject at the Oxford Farming Conference last year. Do you think farmers are becoming more open to things like GM and gene editing?
I certainly think they're aware of it. I do feel frustrated that, unlike me, a whole generation has missed the opportunity to see it in field at first hand in, research trials. That would have been really helpful. The soil health, though, I think is certainly something that has maybe highlighted some of the potential techniques that you can have, and if these help the process, that's fine. But genuinely, for farmers, for it to mean something, they need to see it in a field. You can put all the articles out you like and email transmissions and stuff on the web. But most farmers, they gain their knowledge from farmer to farmer or seeing it in a field situation. And it would be great if the government, at the very least, could actually help facilitate in-field trials so that farmers are perfectly capable of making their mind up as to whether it offers benefit or is use or it'll fit their circumstances.
Well, let's hope we see more of that in future. Okay, well, sadly, I think we'll have to leave it there for today. Thank you to both Mark and Paul for taking time out of the day to talk to us.
And to everyone listening, thank you, and keep your eyes peeled for the next Farmers Guardian Ploughing Through Brexit podcast, which will be out next month. And in the meantime, you can keep up with all the daily political goings-on and how they're affecting agriculture on Farmers Guardian's Brexit Hub at fginsight.com/Brexit.